more of a history talk in some ways with a little bit of philosophy thrown in. But the motivating questions that got me interested in this topic are just their frequent declarations by Wigner and others about the unusual effectiveness of symmetry principles in quantum mechanics. And clearly, just the way symmetries are used in quantum mechanics reflects a lot about the details of the technical structure of the theory. So understanding how symmetry principles and their use differs in classical and quantum mechanics is interesting in any case. But I've ended up pursuing this question more historically by looking at how their use developed in the early days, starting in around 1927. And so that's how I've ended up approaching this question, to try to clarify for myself the way in which symmetry principles are so effective and what's really unusual about them and the way they're employed in quantum mechanics. And then towards the end, I'm going to come back to questions that have been posed in the philosophical literature. So a lot of other philosophers, including prominently Stephen French and Ladyman, have looked at this episode from the historical development of physics and used it to motivate particular positions in philosophy of science. So one claim that's made is that this episode supports a form of ontic structural realism. So towards the end, I'm going to come back and look at those questions. That part of the talk is going to be much more tentative, just because I've ended up fascinated by the history and sort of been more focused on that. And so I'm looking forward to feedback on the more philosophical claims at the end, which I'm proposing in a much more tentative spirit. So what I'm going to do in the talk is look really at the two main figures in the early application of quantum the theory of group representations in quantum mechanics, Eugene Wigner and Hermann Weyl. There were other people involved, of course, but these two are really the two main figures. And they're interesting partly because there's quite different characteristics of their approach, and their work was in some ways headed in different directions or sort of pursuing different projects. And so it's interesting to look at the two of them. So first, I'm going to talk about Wigner and his development of, in effect, recovering a number of results from atomic spectroscopy using the theory of group representations for the permutation group and the rotation group. And then I'll look at Weyl's work and how he thought you could use group theory to explore the foundations of quantum mechanics and really give a different sense of the empirical content of observables in quantum mechanics that they thought the standard formulations didn't give a satisfactory account of. And finally, then, as I said, I'll come back to these claims that have been made in the philosophical literature about structural realism and the group theoretic constitution of bodies. And hopefully, if those are ambiguous, that's fine at this point. I'll say a little bit more about what these claims are meant to be when we get to that section. So really, in 1925 to 1927, there was a convergence of lines of thought from physics and mathematics that led to a lot of very active developments. First, of course, is the sort of downfall of the old quantum theory. There was a lot of experimental data on atomic spectroscopy. And in the old quantum theory, there was an attempt to account for selection rules and all of this, the features of this data in terms of quantization conditions. Bohr used the correspondence principle as an important heuristic guide in trying to reconstruct the structure of the atoms and the orbits of the electrons. But in the early 20s, there were a number of anomalies that had been recognized, the Zeeman effect, the various features of the helium spectra, the ionization energy of diatomic hydrogen. So all of these anomalies had started to accumulate and were sort of well recognized by 1924 or 25. And on the mathematics side, there are some important developments just to highlight two of them. In the early part of, so in the zeros and the teens, there was a lot of work in integral and differential equations, sort of the starting points of functional analysis. And Hilbert, in particular, proved a spectral theorem for bounded linear operators. And this became important, as we'll see in just a moment. There was also a lot of work in the theory of group representations. And in particular, there was work on trying to show how to decompose different groups into their irreducible representations. And there's an attempt to do this for different types of groups. And there's sort of an ongoing project of trying to find the decomposition for different types of groups. And Weil, in particular, in a series of papers in 1925 through 1927, showed that there's a deep connection between this work in group theory and Fourier analysis or harmonic analysis. And so this is something that we'll come back to in a bit. But these, I say that these are converging lines of thought in the sense that with the new quantum mechanics introduced in different formulations around 1925 and 1926, when that is cleaned up by von Neumann and given the standard Hilbert space formulation that we're all familiar with, it draws on this these important developments in the mathematical literature, and in particular Hilbert's spectral theorem, which he generalized, that allowed him to give a refinement and a proof of the equivalence of the wave and matrix mechanics approaches. And Wigner and Weil then essentially employed the mathematics of the theory of group representations, as we're about to see, and drew on this other aspect of the mathematical literature. So, and again, to highlight two different ways in which there was an impact of group theory during this period, George Mackey has characterized these as two different programs, Wigner's program and Weil's program. Wigner's program he labels as the applications of group theory, where it's really just using this mathematical technique to derive the consequences of quantum mechanics for all of these earlier results, the selection rules and atomic spectroscopy, where in effect you can exploit the symmetries to derive all of this earlier results, as Wigner emphasized, almost without computation, namely almost without using detailed dynamical considerations. And on the other side, then, we have Weil's program of refining and clarifying the basic principles of quantum mechanics and the kinematical structure of the theory. And in particular, one thing that's important is that he gave a different way of understanding the canonical commutation relations as a consequence of the fundamental symmetries. And I'm not going to talk about this, I think, other than this slide, but he also has, in effect, what people recognize later as a proposal for quantization. And there's a lot of, well, there's not a lot, but there's some literature on this, which I'm drawing on, in particular, a series of George Mackey's papers describing these developments. And Erhard Schultz has described these developments as well from more of a history of mathematics point of view, and he's also somebody who has looked at Weil's work in particular in considerable detail. So let me now turn to Wigner's entry into the field and how he first applied the theory of group representations in quantum mechanics. So he was responding to a paper by Heisenberg. The terminology at the time was non-combining term systems. What this referred to is missing energy levels for multi-electron atoms. And so there were different term systems, different sequences of transitions that were observed in these atoms, and there were no transitions between these. And so in particular, the helium spectrum splits into para and orthohelium with no transitions between those. And the Heisenberg here proposed to analyze this problem in terms of the permutation symmetry of electrons. And so he wanted to construct the orthogonal subspaces of the n electron state space and argue that the failure to have transitions between those different subspaces could account for this feature of the term systems. Now, as Schultz in particular has emphasized, there are some important problems with Heisenberg's analysis in this 1926 paper. He didn't use group theory at all to define the subspaces. He was only considering the n equals 2 case. And he was trying to construct the subspaces corresponding to interchange of the electrons. But it turns out that what he did do was construct something that wasn't invariant under the full permutation group of the electrons. And so when it came to try to extend this, so first of all, Wigner was able to use similar methods to Heisenberg and extend this to an n equals 3 case. But then he realized that there's a mathematical set of mathematical techniques that he could use to just extend this generally, because as he says in the part one paper that he wrote, going past n equals 3 seemed impossible just using the kind of algebraic methods that he used for the n equals 3 case. And so this was then the first application of the theory of group representations. He was able to use the representation for the representation theory for the permutation group and show then how to decompose the n electron state space into invariant subspaces. Now, how did Wigner do this and what was his background? There's been a lot of emphasis on the fact that he had already seen aspects of group theory in some of his work before, which was unusual for a physicist at that time. This wasn't an area of physics an area of mathematics that a lot of physicists were really actively familiar with. And in particular, he'd worked on crystal structure and come across aspects of group theory in that work. But I think actually, it was also quite important that he was a high school friend of John von Neumann. If you can imagine being Eugene Wigner and not being the brightest mathematician in your high school, well, that's the situation he was in. Von Neumann, I forget, he was either a year older or a year younger than Wigner, but they were in high school together. And in the second paper in this series, he explicitly acknowledges that it was von Neumann who told him, well, this is really the problem you're trying to tackle here is just the representation theory of the permutation group. And as he acknowledges in a footnote, he guessed the correct answers for higher numbers of n greater than 3. And so von Neumann's really the one who alerted him to the mathematical techniques that allowed him to extend past the case he was originally considering. Now, more generally, so this initial work focused only on the case of the permutation group. But of course, Wigner also was interested in considering the rotation group and how that led to results in spectroscopy. And so a simple version of the problem he was looking at would be the case if you had the Hamiltonian and you had a set of operators which all commute with each other and commute with the Hamiltonian. Then you can find simultaneous eigenvectors of these other operators and use those to give a partial diagonalization of the Hamiltonian. Now, the problem that Wigner was actually facing was a problem that was more difficult because the operators that you're interested in wouldn't, in general, commute with each other, but they are closed under products and inferences. In other words, they form a group. And they form a representation of a group. So in particular, for example, if you're looking at rotation, they'd form a representation of the rotation group or the permutation group. So he wants to diagonalize the Hamiltonian, but you can't do the sort of simple thing that you could do in the warm-up example. But you are able to construct invariant subspaces of the representation of the group you're looking at. And in effect, then, the problem he's trying to solve is exactly the same one that the early work in group theory had been focused on, namely decomposing a group into its irreducible representations. And so this earlier set of results was directly applicable to the problem at hand. Now, this is just a definition, which I'm sure for this audience I don't need to review, but the so a representation of a group on a vector space is a collection of operators such that there's a map from the group into the operators. A subspace that is invariant is one in which the operators acting on a vector leave the vector in the subspace. And we can also talk about the restriction of the group representation to that subspace. And then that's a sub-representation of the group on that subspace. And an irreducible representation is one which only has trivial invariant subspaces, namely the whole vector space and the zero vector. So the complete reducibility theorem, so this, I'm forgetting actually who proved this, but this was a result for a particular kind of group. Every representation of a finite dimensional or compact Lie group is completely reducible. This was in place by 1925, I believe. And what completely reducible means is that for every invariant subspace, there's an invariant complement such that you can write the full space as that subspace plus its complement, the vector sum of those. And so if you have something that's completely reducible, then you can decompose it into its component invariant subspace. So there are a variety of special cases. So this is a claim about a particular kind of groups, namely finite dimensional or compact Lie groups. Various other cases for different kinds of groups were proved starting in 1890, going on up. And Weil proves a generalization of this in 1925-26. That's the Peter Weil theorem I was referring to earlier. And there's a wonderful account in Hawkins of the historical development of this. Yes?
Mild technical question. So mm-hmm. this is a trivial statement for finite dimensional representations, right?
Yes, I think that it's
dimensional.
So trivial in the sense that I don't think it's that difficult to prove. I don't know when it was. So I think 1890. So the earlier results. I'm not actually recalling exactly what people, you know, when people first proved those sorts of results. So, but sorry, did you have something?
No, I was just trying to clarify my understanding.
Yeah. Okay. So, my claim is just that Wigner could immediately move to those sorts of results that were available in the literature for understanding the problem he is faced with, namely trying to diagonalize and trying to find the energy spectrum for the Hamiltonian. He could just appeal to these results about how to construct the invariant subspaces of the rotation group and the permutation group in order to resolve these or solve this problem. Now, as I said, Wigner characterized this as plucking spectroscopy from thin air in the sense that the symmetry arguments gave him a fairly direct way of understanding selection rules and other features of atomic spectra that had been discovered prior to his work. And in particular, there were a few things that arose that showed him some of the subtleties of symmetry in quantum mechanics. One was the importance of reflection symmetry. And there's a result in spectroscopy called Laporte's rule that he had to explain by invoking parity inversion. That led him to realize that a few different things. First of all, that in the case of quantum mechanics, because states are represented by rays rather than vectors, you have to, in general, talk about projective or ray representations because there's an ambiguity in associating symmetries with operators. When you look at the product of the operators, there's a term that appears. In effect, because you're looking at mappings between subspaces, one-dimensional subspaces of the Hilbert space, and not directly mappings on vectors. And spin then emerges as a two-valued due to the two-valued representation of SO3. In addition, Wigner's theorem, this is something that he proved in an appendix in the book he published in 1931 after the series of papers that he had worked on, including papers with von Neumann. This appears early in the papers as a footnote, asking if you have a mapping that preserves the transition probabilities in this way, given a scalar product on the Hilbert space, just require for symmetry that it's a mapping such that it preserves these transition probabilities, what could you have that implements that symmetry? And he proved that it could be implemented by a unitary linear mapping or by an anti-unitary, anti-linear operator. And he was forced to consider that because of the issue of parity symmetries, because those are implemented by anti-unitary, anti-linear operators. So again, this is a result that in the process of applying group theory to quantum mechanics, you recognize that you have to be able to that you have to consider anti-unitary operators as well as unitary ones as the ones that implement these symmetry mappings as mappings in the Hilbert space. He also, in this 1931 book, introduced a lot of the, I guess you could call it the technology of angular momentum operators in their addition, just the kind of techniques that you'll find in textbooks now, the notion of tensor operators and the Wigner-Eckhart theorem. These are things that he introduced as he was, so you can trace how these ideas occurred in these earlier papers, and then they're given a presentation in this later book. But these are ways of simplifying the calculations of the coefficients that you need to do. And there's various places where Wigner later comments on the effectiveness of group theory, reflecting on this later work. So he doesn't say anything like this in the 1931 text, but this kind of claim crops up in various places in his later works. So this is just a representative quote. It is the possibility of the formation of the states psi jk with transformation properties 1, and there he's referring to the equation here, which constitutes the greater effectiveness of symmetry considerations in quantum than in classical theory. If the symmetry operations consist of all rotations in ordinary space, one can superpose the states psi rotated in all possible directions. That is, the states OR psi with R with all different values of R, and obtain a spherically symmetric state, unless for some reason when you add these up you get the null vector. No corresponding construction is possible in classical theory. The states can be subjected to symmetry transformations and thus new states obtained, but they cannot be superposed to obtain states with particularly simple properties, such as the states psi jk. Each operation gives only a new state with properties original to the similar to the original one. So here he's just emphasizing that given the linear nature of the state space, given that you can take superpositions of these, you can construct a state out of the states that you generate by acting on initial state with the symmetry. And so the linear nature of the Hilbert space is really what allows you to do this. So I want to take a moment and say something briefly about how Wigner and more generally Weyl's work and the work of other people on group theory was received. This might seem surprising, but this was actually a fairly common comment at the time. This is John Slater writing much later. The authors of the Gruppenpest wrote papers which were incomprehensible to those like me who had not studied group theory. The practical consequences appeared to be negligible, but everyone felt that to be in the mainstream, one had to learn about it. I had what I can only describe as a feeling of outrage at the turn which the subject had taken. It was obvious that a great many other physicists were as disgusted as I had been with the group theoretical approach to the problem. As I heard later, there were remarks made such as Slater has slain the Gruppenpest, which is a horrible mixed metaphor because Gruppenpest is group plague, so I don't know how you slay a plague. But in any case, I believe that no other piece of work I have done was so universally popular. He's referring to, a paper in 1929 where he was looking at atomic spectra, and he notes very proudly in the paper, the objects of the present paper resemble closely those of other writers who employ the methods of group theory. That method is not used at all in the present calculation. And in contrast, no mathematics but the simplest is required until one actually comes to the computation of the integrals. And so he's quite proud of the fact that he's able to re-derive these results without appealing to this horrible new mathematics. It's a little odd in retrospect to see such emphasis placed on the avoidance of group theory, because in essence, he's still using just the Lie algebra of angular momentum operators and just not appealing to the full group theoretic character. And he, you know, is able to do things like avoid using the permutation group by applying the Pauli exclusion principle. So there are some things he just doesn't have to face that Wigner used group theory to do. But it seems, especially given the fact that the angular momentum operators are so close to the group theory in any case, that there's as much emphasis placed on this point. I don't know. So,
for Kramer Slater's paper, uh-huh. He was very bitter about the interaction there and thought he had been slighted by
some community, and it sounds like, once again...
Right, I think Ehrenfest is the source of the Gruppenfest comment, and in that context, it's not entirely clear that he was... Ehrenfest was complaining that he had to learn all this new mathematics, but it's not as clear in that context that he was saying, and it's a horrible thing, as Slater is saying. But it is the case that... So Condon Shortly is a later textbook, and Raka, I'm not sure how to pronounce that actually, much later, also avoided using group theory until sort of at the very end of this series of papers that he wrote, that he starts explicitly using group theory. So it wasn't, you're probably right that Slater is a source of wonderful quotes, partly because he was perhaps more bitter than others, but it wasn't only Slater that sort of carefully avoided appealing to group theory in these treatments of spectroscopy. But it's also the case that it isn't clear to me that the as a question of just an application of understanding atomic spectroscopy, that Slater is so far off in saying that most of what you need to do, you can just do using what, you know, physicists call the addition of angular momentum, just looking at the Lie algebra. Now, there are some things that will end up being a bit puzzling, but it isn't clear that there's actually a lot of impact of the full power of the theory of group representations here. And the other thing is that at the time, you at least did have an approximate Hamiltonian for treating these problems. And there's alternative mathematical techniques, including the ones Slater used and others, that you could apply to the same problem. So it isn't as if in these early days you were forced to use group theory. And so it's not that surprising that Slater and others were able to avoid it. And I just wanted to briefly contrast this with the case of strong interactions in around 1960, as far as I understand it anyway. In that case, you don't have an underlying dynamics for the strong interaction. All you had as a foothold was the approximate SU3 symmetry, the eightfold way of Neyman and Gell-Mann. And so you really actually were using the group theory in a way that was much more central to the problems you're facing than it was in atomic spectroscopy. So now, I know that I probably know less about QCD than almost everyone else in this room, so perhaps that's only a very superficial characterization, but it does seem that there's a way in which group theoretic methods were much more important later on than they were in the early days, just because of the state of knowledge of the full theory. Okay, so now I want to turn briefly to Weil. I think he probably doesn't really need an introduction. He's I've listed a few of the books he wrote there. But let me say something about his interest in quantum mechanics. So as I mentioned earlier, from 1924 to 1926, the final paper appeared in 1927, he was really doing intensive research in the theory of group representations. And here he proved the Peter Weil theorem. This is a rough way of stating the result. Unitary representations of a compact group G decompose into a Hilbert space direct sum of finite dimensional irreps. And the consequence of this, and I realize I haven't stated the full theorem in anything like a precise way, but the consequence of this is that you could, in effect, generalize harmonic analysis to compact groups. And so the characters of the irreducible representations are analogous in a sense to a complete set of orthogonal functions. So you can have a harmonic analysis on groups. And so you can also see earlier work in Fourier analysis as having an important group theoretical character. Now, right on the heels of this research, he started looking into the theory of quantum mechanics. And this is something that Erhard Schultz in particular has described in detail. From the very earliest he heard of the new formulation of quantum mechanics, he was dissatisfied with some aspects of it, and in particular, the canonical commutation relations. He's also concerned about the definition of a state of a system. And so he was one of the first to give the definition of pure states at around the same time that von Neumann did. And he also, of course, was in a very good position to recognize the utility of the theory of group representations for clarifying issues in quantum mechanics. And he very carefully, in his first paper, which was in 1927, on this, said that this connection with group theory leads in an entirely different direction than Wigner's research. So he wasn't just pursuing the application of group theory in the same way.
Chris, can you hang on one point there?
He gave a definition of state of a system. What was the contrasting notion at that time?
There, in some sense, I think it's actually pretty unclear what the state of a system was in matrix mechanics, in Heisenberg's matrix mechanics.
Oh, I see. So
I think there was, I mean,
So the venue wasn't Schrödinger-type mechanics. We had Heisenberg matrix mechanics, and
it might have been
the operators evolved, but we didn't want to call it the state of the system.
Right. So it might have been clearer in Schrödinger's picture how to define the state of a system. But in matrix mechanics, I think there's an important question: how would you define the state of a system? And I don't think it's actually that clear as it is in the Born, Jordan, and Heisenberg paper.
Okay.
Although I have, I mean, this is more reporting what other historians have said. I'm not actually, in any case, I think it's an issue. And von Neumann published a paper in 1927 in which he introduces aspects of the Hilbert space formulation and the notion of a state. It looks like Weil did this independently. So it isn't just building off of what von Neumann has done. Yeah.
Just sort of bootstrapping off of Chris's question. As somebody who works in quantum information theory, I usually think of states as being vectors in a Hilbert space or density matrices. But I know that for people who spend all their time working on operator algebra, there's a really semantically different notion of a state that's mostly due to von Neumann, I think, as a linear functional on bounded observables that's much more mathematically sophisticated. Is that the notion here?
No, that comes later. No, I'm just talking about pure states as one-dimensional subspaces of Hilbert space, or as you can also, I don't actually know when density operators were first introduced, but the operator algebras and so on, and von Neumann had a hand in that later, but in this initial formulation, it's just the sort of standard Hilbert space notion. Okay, so and Weil carefully contrasted this line of work with what Wigner had done, and he sees it as, rather than just applying group theory in order to derive results from atomic spectroscopy, as in some sense refining the mathematical foundations of the theory. So this is just a summary of what I was saying about what von Neumann introduced in 1927. Again, he's extending the Hilbert spectral theorem to unbounded self-adjoint operators. And Weil in 27 thinks that there are two important questions that we can pose regarding this new theory. First, how does one arrive at self-adjoint operators which correspond to various concrete observables? And second, what is the physical significance of these operators? What kind of physical consequences can be deduced from them? And he thinks that actually von Neumann's answer to this was the second question was satisfactory, that the Hilbert space formulation had sufficiently answered that second question. But he thinks that the first question is actually more important, or in any case, it's the one he focuses on. Now, one thing he, as I said, from very early correspondence with Born, was concerned about was the introduction of the canonical commutation relations. And in particular, there's given the way that they're usually introduced, they're well-known domain problems, given that the operators here, these are not bounded operators, and so you have to worry about what domain you're defining the operators over in order to define the canonical commutation relations. Now, Weil in this 27 paper assumed, and this wasn't something that he could prove at this point, but a proof was coming about 3 years later, that you could exponentiate these operators to give one parameter unitary representations of the real line. And then you can avoid these domain problems because the unitary operators you get by exponentiating the other operators are bounded. And so this was something that he just assumed but was proved later by Stone. And that allows you to write down the integrated form of the canonical commutation relations. And as I said, these are unitary operators, so we have no domain problems. And he also thought that you could give a group theoretic derivation of this form of the canonical commutation relations. So very schematically, the idea, again, he's focused on in what sense can you address the empirical content of the observables in quantum mechanics? How do you assign empirical content? That's his question one. He's dissatisfied. He argues that the transit, you know, saying that Poisson brackets go to commutators or something like that relies too much on the structure of classical mechanics. And so he thinks that instead you should start with the Hilbert space structure of the space of states and then define position, momentum, and other observables by their connection with symmetry groups. And so the idea is that you can derive the canonical commutation relations for position and momentum, and in fact the Schrodinger representation for the position operators, just from the appropriate symmetry constraints. And so here's a quote. This is now from his textbook, which was the next year. He says, the kinematical structure of a physical system is expressed by an irreducible group of unitary ray representations in system space. The real elements of the algebra of this group are the physical quantities of the system, the representation of the abstract group by rotations of the system space associates with each such quantity a definite Hermitian form which represents it. This is a project of trying to clarify the sense in which you can derive the canonical commutation relations from symmetry considerations, which George Mackey argues Weil took the first steps in this project, but the initial steps weren't, the things weren't completely filled in. As he says, Weil's answers to the two problems we mentioned above are more suggestive than persuasive or logically compelling, but their importance is perhaps the first step in deriving fundamental relationships in quantum mechanics from group theoretical symmetry principles. And let me mention just two of these subsequent steps. So the one that's more important here is Mackey's imprimitivity theorem from 1949, which draws on the Stone von Neumann theorem. And Mackey's answer to the question of how much you can determine the empirical content of quantum mechanics from symmetry considerations, again, a sketchy version of this, you can define a position observable as the projection valued measure from Borel sets of the real line to projections such that it obeys the following kind of condition, namely that the unitaries which the unitary operators which represent the group acting on the projection map in such a way that you can get the same result by mapping the Borel set with the element of the Euclidean group. So that's then a constraint on what it is for something to be a position. So in other words, the position is defined with respect to say for in this case it's action with respect to the Euclidean group.
I just wondered if you were going to give us the reference for the Mackey 1988.
Yeah, I can give it to you. I'm not sure if I have a slide at the end of the bibliography, but I can certainly give it to you. Now, another thing that he's able to establish is a uniqueness claim that there's only one possible choice of P, E, and UG for each projective representation of the Euclidean group. Now, of course, there's a sense in which Wigner, in his famous 1939 paper on the Poincaré group, shows that you can fulfill this sort of program as well for not just non-relativistic quantum mechanics, but for the Poincaré group. And the result then is that you can define elementary particles as, in a sense, irreducible unitary representations of the fundamental symmetry group, which is the Poincaré group. And it's important to note that this was actually not just an important paper in physics, it was an important paper in mathematics because he was finding unitary irreps of an infinite dimensional, or sorry, of a non-compact group. And that's something that hadn't been done in general. And so this was actually important in group representation theory as well as in physics. Now I want to come back to the philosophical morals that people have drawn from these sorts of considerations. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When it's said that an elementary particle is an irreducible unitary representation, is it correct that the right way to read that is that, you know, the quantum numbers that define the zoo of elementary particles are the irreducible representations? I mean, there's more to a particle than its quantum numbers, but when I often see this statement, mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, is the appropriate interpretation that when they say an elementary particle is, they mean the quantum numbers of that elementary particle?
Right. Well, that's certainly part of the mass and spin, which will label, or other quantum numbers, which will label the irreps, are in effect defining a kind of elementary particle. I'll actually be coming back to this in just a moment, because philosophers have worried about whether there's individuals that you can talk about, whether you can talk about individual elementary particles in a particular way that would add something more than just saying that it's a kind of particle that we're characterizing in terms of these irreps. So maybe you'll just re-raise your question in a moment, but it's something I'll address again. So now, again, this is a much more tentative part of the talk, but there's a number of philosophers who have taken this episode in the history of physics to motivate different philosophical, methodological, or metaphysical positions. Here's a quote from one of them, Stephen French. Let me just draw your attention to the closing part of this quote. So the emphasis on symmetry and invariance subsequently led to a metaphysical categorization of elementary particles as ontologically nothing more than sets of invariances. And an epistemological issue, he says, this later categorization can be adduced as a further aspect of an ontological version of structural realism, which claims not simply that all we can know about the world is this structure, but all that there is about the world is this structure. Okay, so he takes this as supporting a particular version of realism. Now, sometimes the argument for this version of structural realism that he proposes is put in terms of a kind of metaphysical underdetermination, focusing on the application of permutation invariance, which is one of the first the first application that we saw with Figner's work. And this is, again, a quote from French. The formalism can be taken to support two very different metaphysical packages, one in which particles are regarded as non-individuals in some sense, and another in which they are regarded as philosophically classical individuals for which certain states are rendered inaccessible. So what he means here is that in accounting for the different statistics, the different types of quantum particles, he's arguing that there are two different ways of understanding individuality in these cases. And from the fact that these two packages, as he puts it, are available, he concludes there is then a kind of metaphysical underdetermination of metaphysics by the physics. In other words, the physics doesn't single out what you mean by individuality in this domain. And in order to respond to this underdetermination, the appropriate thing to do, according to French and others, is to only have a realist commitment to relational structures without any further underdetermined claims regarding individuals. Sometimes in slogan form, this is characterized as relations without relata. Now, there are a few replies to this. The first is just a direct reply to the argument from this kind of metaphysical underdetermination. There's a very careful assessment of this by Oliver Pooley, who's the next speaker in April. And Simon Saunders has also criticized the arguments of French and Ladyman. I'm not going to address that issue here, but I want to turn to our another way of responding to this, and then briefly advocate a third way. So one avenue of response is argued for by Peter Mittelstadt and Elena Castellani, and the label that they put on this is a group theoretic constitution of individual objects, let me skip over the quote that just indicates what the problem is that she's facing. So she gives a, this is from Castellani, gives a definition of a Galilean particle. It's an elementary system for which the observable's position, momentum, and time are defined. And what she means by define are, she cashes this out in terms of Mackey's imprimitivity theorem, where position and momentum, I think time is a little problematic, but in any case, position and momentum are defined in the sense of Mackey's imprimitivity theorem following from the groups, the Euclidean group in the case of Galilean particle. There's a problem here in that you might have a well-defined position observable, but that doesn't mean you have anything like a well-defined trajectory, which if Castellani and the quote before indicated that I think she is interested in individuating particles in the sense of identifying them over time in some way consistently. Just because you have a position observable that follows from the symmetries doesn't mean you have anything like a trajectory. And in fact, Mittelstadt is very clear about this. The only way you can reconstruct a trajectory in any sense is by shifting to unsharp position and momentum observables. And so this isn't a classical trajectory that you're reconstructing, which isn't surprising because it's, after all, a quantum particle. Yeah?
Question first, which is, why do we need, I mean, it's a really hilarious line, ordering in my mind. It seems to me defining properties through time has more to do with the ability to predict them than really something that's ontic. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you can have sort of indeterministic kind of reality or something. And that's my second question. My first question is, so you lost me like two slides ago.
Okay.
Following up on what Rob asked about. So if I parse that bottom sentence about elementary particles being mm-hmm. defined as the IREFs.
Right.
I mean, if I read that as, you know, GM produces so many cars and I can identify each car by its make, its model, its mm-hmm. color.
Right.
Because when I talk about those properties, I'm not talking about a particular car, I'm talking about a category of car.
Right.
And that seems like a totally different notion of reality than you're shifting to here, which is...
Right. And I am going to advocate exactly the line you're pushing, right? That we don't need to have this account of individuation, but this is something that some philosophers do think we need. And I think you're asking exactly the right question. Why would we need individuation in this sense? And I think it's, I mean, part of the point is that I think you can try to force this, but it doesn't seem like a very natural thing. First, because the notion of individuation you get is going to be bizarre. And partly because it isn't clear to me why you have to be answering these questions about individuation in any case. So that's, in effect, my third reply. And this is partly motivated. There's a paper that Catherine Brading gave about Newton's position on the notion of bodies, where you can, so Newton explicitly formulates the laws of motion in terms of bodies, and you can ask, well, what bodies is it that we're talking about when we formulate the laws of motion? And the line she advocated, and I've called the dynamical conception of bodies, she has a different label for it, the bodies are in fact just implicitly defined by the dynamical laws. And in fact, the properties that these bodies have are in part reflected by what we require of them in order to have the well-formulated laws and to have the laws apply to them. So for example, in Newton's formulation of the laws of motion, the question of parthood of a body isn't clear because the laws of motion as he formulated them didn't have any implications for subsets of bodies or that are as rich as what you get in continuum mechanics, right? So in precise formulations of continuum mechanics, you have to say something very careful about the subsets of bodies and whether those also count as bodies. So that's, in effect, a constraint coming from the dynamics that determines what you mean when you talk about bodies, right? So bodies, what counts as bodies, are implicitly defined through the dynamical laws. In some sense, the laws come first. It isn't a question of what bodies are there that the laws apply to, but rather, once we've seen that the laws are established, those give us a sense of what the nature of bodies are. And the further claim, which I want to suggest, is that it's not clear to me why we would need any further sense of any further commitment regarding what an individual is, above and beyond our claims about what it takes for something to be a body. Yeah.
I'm really getting confused here, because I think these questions we're getting at something. This first sentence makes sense in the sense if you're talking about if bodies is supposed to be types. Types of bodies are defined by the dynamical laws. If it's talking about particular bodies, then it doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, this sense of reality doesn't have any room for the state. It's as if some people want to say that it's a kind of realism which tries to take the dynamical laws as telling you what the world is, and which leaves no room for the state of the world in providing any additional room for what the world is. So, you know, it's just a simple point, right, that this...
I actually don't understand, so...
It's just that, you know, if you say that an electron is an irreducible representation of the Lorentz group, mm-hmm. or the Poincaré group, whatever it is, then, you know...
Well, there's the difference between saying that there's a kind of particle
right.
that's determined to have those properties by the way it figures into the dynamical laws. And what are you saying then? Then electrons
so
as an individual
that makes
thing?
Sense, and that seems to be what Grading is getting at here, right? But then this business about individuation has to mm-hmm. do with, well, somebody who wants to say, presumably, well, there's a certain number of electrons that make up that laptop, right? I mean, this is when you're going to start wanting to individuate or localize particles or something. Now, that information is contained not in the laws, but in the state mm-hmm. of the universe. So I don't understand. I'm not sure what this is supposed to be.
I'm not denying any realism about the state. The claim isn't that.
Right.
So I think actually part of the shift is a question of what's appropriate as part of sort of the understanding of the formalism versus applications of it to a particular system. So I'm perfectly happy saying that when you're applying a formalism to describing a particular system, there might be relevant questions about individuation that arise. I don't think I'm denying anything about the...
Well, I was confused by your response to Rob's earlier question about what does it mean to say that a particle is an irreducible representation. Mm-hmm. of the Lorentz group. You mean a particular particle, it seems to make no sense, right? It's like a kind of thing.
Right.
Right. That's all that this is about. This whole discussion is just about kinds.
Well, I want to deny that there's, it's not clear to me what the further, so in some sense I'm sympathetic to the structural realist in saying that I think there's, there is a sense in which I'm not going to talk further about individuals, but it's partly because it just doesn't seem to me what role that plays, and it's not that I'm retreating from a commitment to individuals because I can't determine what they are based on the physics. It just seems that it's not clear to me what the further question is that's being posed about the particular individuals at the level of the formalism as opposed to the application. But let me say one more thing, and maybe we can come back.
Yeah, keep going.
I'm almost, actually, this is the last little bit. So the so first of all, just in reply to Castellani, I think it's odd to try to employ the imprimativity theorem to try to constitute individuals in a sense of identity over time. I just don't think that works so well. I think it's much more natural to say, well, what the imprimativity theorem allows you to do is to show explicitly how you can define observables via their connections to symmetries. And regarding the notion of elementary particles as irreps, I think the notion of elementary here, I think we should think of as similar to being plane waves in Fourier analysis. In other words, they're particularly useful due to the linear structure of Hilbert space, and because they're useful decomposition into the invariant subspaces, we can think of them as elementary in that sense. And I think I'll end there and open for questions. I'm sure that won't be completely satisfying for the two of you, but maybe we can just go straight into discussion. So thanks for coming. Okay, sure. Yeah.
All right, so I guess I'm gonna continue pursuing Steve and Rob and the question to some degree. And really, I guess what I'm probably going to do here is present the sort of mouth-breathing undergraduate stupid response, but I hope to learn from it. Inasmuch as I understand the statement that particles are, quote unquote, irreducible representations of the Poincaré group, it seems to me like a statement of mathematical convenience. And I'm surprised to see it being given philosophical weight. I understand it as saying, if we want to know what different flavors of particle there are in this humongous Hilbert space, then we take it as a mathematical principle that if you can apply the Poincaré group, if you can boost or rotate or accelerate or translate, then those transformations do not change one flavor of particle into another flavor of particle. But underlying that is the notion already that particles are described by quantum fields, their excitations, blah, blah, all of this stuff that's radically divergent from Newtonian mechanics. And so to see the philosophical analysis of individuality brought into that is leaving me sort of baffled. Okay, can the philosophers help me understand?
Well, I'm actually, I think, arguing against the way in which the structural realists and the people who try to constitute objects are trying to import individuality. I'm much more on the side of, you know, this is partly an issue of something more like applied mathematics, right? That the elementary particles are useful in the way you described and for the reasons you described. So I don't, I mean, I'm more sympathetic. So I'm you know, again, this is a position that I obviously need to think through more carefully, but the claim is, it's not clear to me that to be a realist about the theory, you have to be committed to individuals in any strong sense. It seems to me adequate to say, well, we've discovered that there are natural kinds of particles. Those can be instantiated by various particular systems, and that's it. I don't have to be able to say something more about the nature of those individuals so that I can, say, identify them at different times, or, you know, the sorts of things that the structural realist is saying we can't do. In some sense, I'm agreeing in some way with the structural realist, but I'm just, you know, I'm not motivated by a metaphysical underdetermination problem. I'm just saying it's not clear to me what further role those questions of individuality really play.
It strikes me as a kind of a weird hybrid of sort of what Hacking would call, it's fresh in my mind from teaching it, theory realism and entity realism. So the emphasis here is entirely on the theories, but there's an insistence on talking about things that look like entities, which are particles, right? That you're somehow taking a lesson about the ontology, about the things in the theory, rather than making just a truth claim about the theory. Accompanied by a resistance to, you know, individuating the particles, right? So this, okay, quantum theory doesn't allow us, this is a funny statistic, we can't individuate the particles, so I better not do that. But geez, it looks like there are things that are particles out there. So I'm going to call them irreducible representations of the Lorentz group.
So do you say, when I analyze an electromagnetic wave, that, hey, it's useful to decompose that into plane waves, and therefore there are plane waves out there as entities? I mean, is that the kind of move that you're...
I wasn't really suggesting a move. I just thought that... It seems like somebody who's going to be a structural realist shouldn't be talking about the entities at all.
Well, I certainly think you can talk about, you know.
What happens is that you get into this kind of confused, what strikes me as a kind of a, I just don't know what, you want to talk about kinds of things without having any things. Right, so this is what the irreducible representations of the Poincaré group categorize, the different sort of kinds of objects that there are. But then there's a resistance to sort of saying that in any particular case there are some objects with these properties. That's how, is that, am I not understanding?
I don't think that follows from what I've said. And I'm not sure exactly why it is that you think I'm committed to that. Maybe this is something that looks like it follows from my position. I mean, again, it's not the. So, in what sense are we committed to saying that there are not just kinds of objects that particular systems can instantiate, or sort of structural differences between things that obey, act differently under permutations, right? You think that acknowledging that forces me into making claims about individuating particles. And I don't actually see why that's...
Maybe this is related, actually.
Yeah.
You still have particles out there. I mean, if you're not interested in individuals or individuating, is this? Are you saying there are different types of objects, and these objects either be particles or fields, or we don't have to be any more precise about the sorts of things they are? We just know that there are principal physical differences between these categories of X objects, or, well, you might not even want to say they're objects, right? You might even want entities. That's the vaguest ontological term I can think of. But.
Right, so I certainly don't want to be committed to saying that they're particles if that includes all the baggage of, you know, localizable,
of course,
and so on. I mean, so. I would hope that all this would follow if you move to a Fox phase and you're talking about elementary particles in terms of, I mean, I don't think that there's a distinction between particles and fields that's going to do a lot of work. The irreps will still be useful in the Fox phase formalism and so on. So I don't think speaking of them as elementary particles bears that kind of baggage.
Okay, I'm wondering if you're being agnostic about that. I can see. Mm-hmm. That you want to be a realist about the importance of these distinctions between different irreducible representations of the CCRs or whatever.
Right.
And those give you differences between types of entities, but then you could be agnostic about exactly what those entities are like, except you know that there are these differences between. So is that the idea?
Yeah, so it also would depend. So if you're trying to pin me down on whether commitment to sort of different kinds of entities in this way commits me to further saying that there's individuals that instantiate those kinds. Well, I mean, partly it's, you know, there are different things that you might mean by what it is to be an individual. And I probably have to be much clearer about which of those I think are supererogatory, which of those I don't have to address, even though I can say things about different kinds of particles, right? So I think what I probably need to do in response to both these questions is say more precisely in what sense it is that I think the question of what individuals are there, how am I thinking of individuals, you know, what are the different criteria that you can have individuals, you know, identifiable over time, trans-world identity, you know, just being able to count them, you know, what...
So it's going to be some thin notion of individual.
Right, right. So I think I probably need to clarify that. But the part of the point is that I think you can get to this position without going through the route of the structural realist, where you say there are definite notions of individuals and we just can't tell which one is right. The point is that in order to interpret the theory, you've done all the work necessary without sort of specifying what individual objects there are. And that's
the point. It's the point where you're saying there's relations all the way down.
Right. That's not part of, yeah, I don't want to, yeah. Yeah, go on.
I might be useful to say, you know, I'm going to try to bring the analogy with braiding and then casting, but that might help clarify things. Braiding wants to, one of the things that she was very impressed with was the extent to which when you start to follow some of the details, for example, in the argument for universal gravitation, all of a sudden you're hitting the center of mass of a whole group of things. That counts as a body. So you have, instead of thinking of bodies as these little individual hard things or planets and stuff, you really expand the notion. And so you have sort of, it becomes, you have a much wider account of what can count. Now, there's nothing meant in the way she does that to say that when I'm applying, when it's being applied to the solar system, and you're using the Newton Newton's uses a center of mass construction to show that the Copernican system is almost right, though it is wrong, and the Ptolemaic is complete, it's really wild. And the application of the details, she's not saying that there isn't anything like I'm individuating these planets. Right? You search, that's not meant to be, that's not meant to be removed, which he talks this way.
That's what I meant by saying there's a distinction between formalism and application. And I think part of the question is, do you have to try to introduce sort of individuals in a really rich sense in just the description of the formalism, as opposed to here I have a description of a particular situation, and then I can talk about how, you know, there's a formal description of something that's individuated within that situation.
So now, I mean, suppose we're running a two-slit experiment. You want to, you're talking about that experiment on that occasion, right? Mm-hmm. But you want to, what you're pointing out is that various issues about how, what has to count as an individual in explicating that, there's a, I mean, you went through various lines that one could take, and you want to, you're suggesting something that's not, that's allowing more than the structural realist would allow, but still not. Okay, I want to, I'm just trying to feel it, I mean.
Right, so, okay. Yeah, so, I mean, I think it's helpful to say, look, it isn't that when you have a set of equations describing a particular system that you can't individuate objects in that system in some way. It's the, at the level of the formalism, I don't see that in order to be a realist about the theory that you have to also be able to say, I can individuate objects. And again, this comes back to, well, what do I mean by individuating things at the level of the formalism. So, I mean, I think that that's, and I don't know what the structural realist will say about that kind of distinction, but I think my guess is that's one place where we differ. Yeah.
Can I come at this from a slightly different point of view? What about the distinction between essential and accidental products? Let's go back to the classical thing. So bear in mind that when we get to relativist quantum theory, localization is a real problem. Individuation of particles, particle number, and all of that are really problematic. There still seems to be some sense in which one wants to have some of these irreducible representations classifying types of particles in terms of essential properties, right? But then there's another aspect in which you want to say that a given system or whatever, or field or whatever it is that comes out of the individual has to be in some region, otherwise you're not going to know what other field it's interacting with, and you're not going to be able to apply it to physics at all. So there has to be some sort of more general sense in which you can talk about the dynamic properties of the system.
Right.
Again, maybe with an irreducible representation, but surely that's going to be a different one, because you were talking about the individual system.
Right. No, I mean, I've been maybe too quick in saying that. I think that's the distinction between formalism and application. In an application of a particular system, I think you're going to have all kinds of ways in which you can individuate. And, you know, you're then describing the particular system as having this many constituents of different sorts. And so I don't see any problem with that. It's rather just at the level of just, you know, position as defined in standard quantum mechanics or following the imprimatur theorem. How do you then use that to individuate an object? Well, that seems like an ill-posed question to me.
So I think my intuition is the same as yours, just hoping that.
Yeah, no, thank you. Yeah.
So I wonder whether the, so I don't remember the narrative of your talk exactly, but I'm curious whether the argument for metaphysical indetermination by French was meant to be an argument in favor of this slogan that elementary particles are irreducible representations.
No. It was supposed to follow in some way from that.
So here is an argument that one could make, and I'm curious whether this is something that's out there, people make this argument or not, which is if you grant that you either have to admit that there are individuals and then restrict the state space, or just deny that there are individuals, and you go the latter route, you deny that there are individuals, and you could say, well, our notions of what are the entities and what are the properties has changed. Previously, we thought entities were particles, and they had properties like position momentum. But now we realize, actually, the only entities there are field modes. You know, field modes are described by a wave vector and a spin and, you know, maybe a color charge. And the only properties that those field modes have are occupation number and maybe
That's shifting the Fox space formalism.
Right. So you change the Fox space formalism, your notion of what entities are changes completely. And then a slogan that would be appropriate is that the elementary entities are irreducible representations of the Poincaré group. Because if you ask what are all the different entities that are out there, it would just be list all these irreducible representations. So that seems like a reasonable argument, but it strikes me as not the argument that's being made.
It's not the argument that French is making, because that's supposed to follow just from permutation invariance and non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So it's not French's argument, but the, I mean, I think the line of argument you sketched is something I'm very sympathetic to. I mean, I didn't focus on the issues of the rising quantum field theory of localizability, but in some sense, that's the distinction of kinds of entities that I want to say you're given when you recognize that elementary particles are just irreps of the. I mean, all so what you've added is shifting to occupation number in a Fox space formalism, which I think is completely compatible with the position I was sketching. And so I don't see how it's an argument for French's position, which is that what you were proposing, that it's a different way of giving an argument for?
Well, I was just wondering whether people might respond to this sentiment that we've heard many times from the audience that what we're talking about with the irreducible representations are the flavors of particles, or the kinds of particles. And that strikes me as saying, oh, the irreducible representations are a certain kind of property of a particle. And the response would be, no, you've got it all wrong.
I see.
These are the different kinds of entities.
Right.
And their properties are numbers and phases.
Right.
But what we're really listing here are the kinds of entities.
Right. No, I think that's actually a very nice way of stating the point. So you don't think of particles as sort of bearers of properties as just being kinds of entities that are characterized by the quantum numbers associated with their irreps. Yeah, I think that's. I don't know if there's.
I have a good friend. What is French trying to address? Because I thought that we, one of the things we learned from permutation symmetry is that we shouldn't think of particles as individuated. You permute and you don't have a different state of affairs. And we ought to think of what's going on out there as something like modes of a quantum field. So
he thinks it's actually possible to have a labeled particle formalism where you actually then just say that there are, I mean, you treat permutation symmetry very differently. You say that
but you can do that, and you quotient out
exactly
under permutation of the labels, and you end up something like this. You ought to end up in the same place that you end up if you didn't start out with particle labels.
Right, but the point is, he thinks that you've got then two distinctive metaphysical packages, one in which you have individuals, and I forget exactly how to put it. This is the. I mean, there's a longer argument, and he's got several earlier papers saying that spelling out how this is supposed to work. Actually, this is.
Next
one.
Oh,
okay. Yeah, one in which particles are regarded as non-individuals in some sense, another which they're regarded as possible individuals for certain states are rendered inaccessible. So, and I think. Some people argue against him directly by saying, no, you don't have two consistent metaphysical packages. So I think this is Simon's line. If you understand individuality in an appropriate way, you can see that, you know, there isn't an underdetermination here because one of them is clearly correct. I mean, there's one appropriate way of talking about particle statistics and permutation.
Okay, I think I understand French a lot because I often find myself in situations where people will say one thing one way, say what sounds to me like exactly the same thing, express in different language, and say, here are two different metaphysical pictures we have to decide
right.
What is right, and then you bring your intuitions in,
right.
Which is supposed to be informative about the ultimate nature of reality. Okay, so.
Right, yeah, I often have that worry about metaphysics as well, that you end up with a kind of re-description which is meant to be substantive, which sometimes it isn't clear what it is.
We thank Chris again. Yeah.